Good news. Good news, Jamaica. For those of you that are familiar with our work, you probably realize that that's the name of the website that we operate while we're in the country, so you can keep aware of our activities, those of us who are on the trip. Leave us a note, see what we're up to, things like that. There's no official title, of course, for this work, but I think this will suffice because there is, in fact, good news in Jamaica. That's what I've come to share with you today. George and several others from this congregation have been able to go over the years. As he mentioned this morning, that's how I got acquainted with him. Want to keep you aware of what's going on there. Keep the brothers and sisters there in your prayers. Keep the work there in your prayers. So I'll share some information about this year's trip, and then some historical background, and then we'll go from there. Usually we're able to get a group picture at a place called Lover's Leap, which is a big cliff, and we usually always try to take a big group picture there. We weren't able to do that this year, so this is the best I could do, is piece together a few pictures taken at Pizza Hut on our last night there. Just a little bit of information about the group this year. We had 24 people from across the United States. We had people from Texas, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Kentucky, Nevada, Minnesota, Ohio, and parts of Canada. So pretty diverse group again this year. We missed some old friends this year, but had a good group, a lot of returning veterans, and things went pretty smoothly. It's good to have everybody, and there may be some faces there that you recognize. As we've done the last several years, we spent the first week in Savannah Lamar, which is on the south side of the island. It's the place that's a little more rural, as you'll see by the cows walking across the road there. To my mind, it's a little bit harder to do the VBS there. We have a lot bigger crowd. There's more setup and stuff like that that's required. But it's a good place. The congregation there is larger than in Montego Bay. For the most part, things are going well. We had a men's leadership class while we were there, trying to help build them up and things like that. The Lawson family, Errol Lawson is the preacher there, and his father was the preacher before him. So they sort of are the core group almost at that church. Errol's mother's been very sick for some time. You may remember last year she was completely bedridden. She's doing some better this year. She's able to walk around the house a little bit, but Errol's business is not doing well. He's depending primarily on the support that he receives from the United States. And there are problems that come from that as well. But the first week was good. We spent our time, as we do the entire trip there, teaching and preaching. I flew into Montego Bay on Friday, July 3rd, and about four other members of the group did as well. And we spent a couple days getting things set up, and then most people arrived on the 4th and 5th. And we got Vacation Bible School started on July 6th in Savannah Lamar. This year's lessons were on the first family, Genesis chapters 1 through 4. We talked about the story of Adam and Eve, God's plan for the family, the first sin, and then the story of Cain and Abel. And I'm sure you know from some of the background that George has given you that lots of family problems there. It's very prominent. Most of them come from single-parent households or otherwise non-traditional households. And just to see the impact that has on their social lives, their education, also their spiritual life, it's tremendous. And it's amazing what a big difference that can make. So we talked to them about that, what God's plan for the family is, and how they don't have to repeat the same mistakes that earlier generations did, how they have an opportunity to turn it around. And we'll see the fruit of that. It may be years before we see that, but hopefully we're able to get across to some of them the fact that they don't have to repeat those same mistakes, that they can look to the Bible and see how God designed the family originally, how they can, still living in this world where we all make mistakes, how they can do their best to follow that plan, follow that example. You see a picture there of the middle school class. We meet outside, all except the primary class, which is the youngest children. We all meet under various trees and stuff for shade. So that's myself and Sarah Lyon, who's been for about 8 years or so teaching the middle school class there. She and I have done that together for about the past 4 years. That's kind of my niche, kind of where I fit in. I enjoy seeing those kids quite a bit. So that was good. Our attendance started off the first day kind of small, as it always does. You know, you got to get the word out, things like that. But we had 247 at Vacation Bible School by the end of the week, which was a pretty good-sized crowd. And, of course, all of the problems that come from managing that number of kids. You know, that was a bigger than 10-to-1 ratio of kids to adults. And when you have a lot of the disciplinary problems and things like that that you see there, it brings with it certain challenges. But it was very encouraging to see so many, despite the various hardships. And 184 at our evening preaching, the gospel meeting that we had there by Thursday night, we had 184 packed into a building that's probably only half the size, and just from the back pew forward. So close quarters, but it's good to be shoulder to shoulder with so many people who have come to hear the Word of God. It was very encouraging. We had 4 baptisms that Thursday night. We had, starting at the top and going clockwise, we had Melissa, who was in our middle school class. And on the last day, what I always try to do is tie together that week's lessons, tie that together with the gospel message, relate that to Jesus somehow, and show about that. And she showed particular interest while I was doing that. And so we had a conversation afterward about what it meant to be a Christian. And she was sort of raised in the church. Her family attends church there. So she was pretty familiar with that already. And then Renee, who you see on the right there, and Romario, who's on the left, they were both in the high school class. They both came from denominational backgrounds, and they studied with us in the afternoon some, and they both decided that they were ready to become Christians as well. And then Shanika there at the bottom had studied with David and Flora Tant, who are sort of the matriarch and patriarch of our group, if you will. They studied with her back in January, and she wasn't ready to make a commitment at that time. But they studied with her some more, and she decided that she was, in fact, ready to become a Christian. So 4 all baptized on Thursday night. Very encouraging. Luke Harrison is the guy there on the left. He studied with Romario, so he wanted to baptize him. And then I baptized the other 3. It was the first time for either of us to do that. And you know, while it didn't have any real impact on their salvation, just that we were there, it was very encouraging to be a part of bringing them into the kingdom in that way. And something that he and I will never forget, right there on a spillway at the edge of the Caribbean Sea. Just a huge joy to welcome them into the kingdom. Then Sunday in Savannah Lamar, you see Errol there. He's baptizing Dwayne, Shaquille, and Colleen. They all decided that they wanted to become Christians as well. Most of them have backgrounds in the church and knew. They just had yet to make that commitment. And so a congregation of about 85 people and 7 baptisms, that's about a 12% increase just in a week. So we really need to pray for them that they will stay strong, that they'll stay true to the commitments that they've made, and that the church there will be able to teach them as they should and give them that grounding that they need. As I said, it was a real pleasure to welcome them into the kingdom. You see David Tant there with them, hearing them make their confession of faith. We spent the weekend in the middle of our trip, as we generally do. We went on Friday, I guess it was, to go see Marlon and Aretta. I'm sure most of you are familiar with their story. They're kind of isolated there, about 3.5 hours from either of the congregations that we work with. So it can be very hard for them to stay encouraged and to stay strong in what they're doing. But Aretta has been working on her nursing certification for several years, and she received that in July. So she'll now be able to work full-time for employment. And Marlon, as you know, is a paraplegic. Can't really move from the neck down. But he studies his Bible whenever he can, helps the children with their homework, things like that. And we took him in an electric wheelchair about 2 years ago, I guess. And anytime he's able to get out and about, he goes and talks to his neighbors about things that he's been studying in the Bible and has conversations with them about that. And so as much as we think we're going there to encourage them, there's so much encouragement that comes our way as well to see their example despite all the many difficulties that they go through. And their children are doing well, continuing to do well in school, receiving some of the top marks in the island, and I think they'll go on to do very good things. But it's been a great blessing for Aretta to receive her certification and to be able to find employment that way. Where she works is it's a pretty decent drive away, and she'll have to sometimes spend the night there if she's working really long shifts. So that will bring with it its own difficulties, but just having employment for her is a a great thing. So we need to praise the Lord for that, certainly. And our second week, as has been the case for the last several years, was spent in Montego Bay. Again, different congregation there. Quite a different environment, being so urban, being so tourist-oriented. The things that you see there are different. But people are the same in the world over. They need encouragement. They need lessons about how to live faithfully and things like that. Maxwell James, who is the preacher there, he's continuing to work as a taxi driver, and so that brings with it some long nights and some tired mornings. But we see some of the young men there really rising to the occasion, doing things like leading singing, waiting on the table, things like that, getting involved in the public worship. And so it's good to see that next generation of leadership sort of rising up. Vacation Bible School there, again, we had about 100 in attendance each day. It remained fairly stable there. Not a huge amount of growth throughout the week. I think we started out with about 85 and grew to about 115 during the week there. But good to see all of those kids. We also had a women's class there. And what you see in the picture at the top left is Megan Jones, who's been going for about 10 years herself, talking to a girl named Rajni. And I don't know how much George has told you about them, but Rajni and her sister Milan are the children of a man named Raju, who is one that we go to for changing money, changing our currency to Jamaican money quite often. And so that developed as sort of a business relationship, but now it's become much more of a personal relationship. He trusts his kids to come with us, to come to Vacation Bible School with us. Where we do the Vacation Bible School is not in the safest area. These girls are part of the Indian minority in Jamaica, sort of a merchant class, relatively well-to-do economically. So for them, for their parents to feel comfortable sending them to this dangerous neighborhood with us really attests to the strength of that relationship. And the girls there, they had some really serious conversations with Megan and asked her some tough questions about what it really meant to be a Christian young woman and follow all of God's commands for that and the challenges that would arise. And Megan was very frank with them and helped them to understand the challenges there, but helped them to understand that there's joy in it also. And she's very good at communicating that kind of thing. Again, I worked with the middle school class. This was my fourth trip, so we have about a three-year window for the middle school class. So all these faces in this picture are new compared to my first year. We didn't have any of the same kids, so I've gone through a complete cycle of seeing these kids and seeing all these different faces. And when I realized that, it really helped me to realize the amount of time that I'd been going, that hopefully there has been an impact. And, you know, we are seeing some changes as we go back year to year, but it really takes several years before you can start to see the fruits of this kind of labor. And then in the picture at the bottom left, I'm tying a balloon animal. I learned how to do that earlier this year and thought it would be a neat prize for them. So whenever they were especially enthusiastic about the singing that we do before the lessons each day, or did their memory verse or things like that, they got a balloon animal, and that was sort of their prize. We usually give them some sort of prize at the end of the week for coming. But they enjoyed that, and that encouraged a lot more participation. Again, the lessons were largely focused on hearts and homes. I taught a lesson on being tender-hearted, being renewed in the spirit of our minds, being compassionate to others, not letting all the things that they see in their day-to-day lives get them down and make them hard-hearted and callous to the world going on around them. How, as Christians, we're supposed to keep our hearts open and not shut ourselves off from having compassion for one another. And that's a struggle that they go through, and you know, it's not uncommon to any of us, but they really have a hard time with that. It's easy to become calloused when you go over there, because you see so many of the same problems day to day, and so many of the struggles that they go to can be quite discouraging. So we wanted to kind of get that message across to them. And again, the lessons focused on homes, teaching them how building strong families starts with decisions that they'll make at a very early age. It was a question that I had to really ask myself, if it was appropriate to talk to 10, 11, and 12-year-olds about what it meant to be sexually pure, what it meant to obey God's rules for marriage. And here in the United States, that would seem a bit strange. That would be a bit young for that kind of lesson. But over there, there's a chance that if I don't talk to them at 12 years old about this kind of thing, that when they come back next year and they're in the high school class and they're 13, they've got a baby on their lap when they're listening to that lesson. And so I was just convicted that if I didn't share this message with them at such a young age, that pretty soon they'll be making decisions that will affect the course of the rest of their lives. And it's really never too early to start those kind of lessons over there. And just by virtue of the culture that they grow up in, the environment, the types of families that they have, and the way that men and women interact over there, it's very different. It's a world apart. It can seem so similar, so easy, because we're going over there, we're speaking the same language, they wear the same kinds of clothes that we do and stuff like that. But there really are fundamental differences in the culture. And you have to know how to approach those. But overall, a very productive year, I would say. We had some serious conversations with people who needed to hear them. And I think the lessons overall hit a lot of the things that we needed to touch on. And I think we shared some things that can have a big impact. As I said, it may take years to see the fruits of that, but it's important that we keep going, keep trying, things like that. So to give a little bit of the historical background, what I mainly wanted to look at here was the Rastafarians. They're a small minority in the religious community there, maybe only about 10% of Jamaicans. So I don't want to paint this picture or stereotype that all Jamaicans are Rastafarians or anything like that. But in the same way that Christianity here has a lot of ideas that are in the public square and are relatively common to our culture, it's the same way over there. Even someone who maybe is not a Rastafarian will share many of these ideas. So I wanted to kind of talk about the background of that movement and give you just some historical information and some application of that. The way it really started was in 1927, a man named Marcus Garvey, who was a political activist, returned to Jamaica from spending some time in the United States. As I said, he was a social activist. He really wanted to start a movement of some sort. And the type of movement that he wanted to start is what at the time was called Pan-Africanism, which was that African people all over the world in the Caribbean, North and South America, various places like that, should return to Africa and create a homeland there. And he said that was something that had been prophesied in the Bible, and that it would soon come that they would all return back to Africa and set up their own kingdom there. Sort of a utopian idea of a perfect society created by people returning to Africa. He said the sign that they would know that time was to come was the sign of an African king sitting on an African throne. They were supposed to look for that, and when they saw that, they would know that it was time to go back to Africa. Well, in 1930, Ross is the Ethiopian term meaning prince. So a man named Tafari, who was a prince, Ross Tafari, was crowned Haile Selassie I, emperor of Ethiopia. Now, by virtue of this coronation, by becoming king of Ethiopia, he also became the head of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And his official title was Emperor of Ethiopia, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Conquering Lion of the Tribe of Judah, the Elect of God, and Light of the World. Because the Ethiopians have a myth that their royal family dates back all the way to Solomon and Sheba. That Solomon and Sheba had a child and that he became really the first king of Ethiopia, and that they're all descended from him. And once he was crowned, he appeared on the cover of Time magazine, and those who had been listening to Marcus Garvey's message heard this and realized or thought that this was the African king on the African throne and that it was time for them to create this perfect society. Well, it was a bit difficult for them to go back to Ethiopia, but they started ascribing to him this sort of mythical, almost messianic status. It became even harder to go back to Ethiopia when in 1935 it was invaded by Italy. Ethiopia was the last African country to come under the control of European colonizers. And that was another thing that had sort of built up Rastafari in their eyes, is that he had resisted the Italians. In the 1880s, they tried to invade, and they lost. The Europeans were defeated. But in 1935, Benito Mussolini invaded, conquered Ethiopia, and Emperor Selassie and his family fled to London. They went there and sought refuge. It was at this point that the Rastafarian movement began to take on a very anti-colonial feel because of the Italians coming in and colonizing Ethiopia. So the Ethiopians began to resent the Italians, and Jamaicans at the time were under the control of Great Britain. And so they began to resist their colonial power as well. And they used a lot of biblical language, language from the book of Revelation and elsewhere, referring to the colonizing power as Babylon. And so it became this sort of religious but also a political and social movement with a lot of anti-European, anti-colonial sentiment to it. And then from 1940 to 1970 was a period of persecution for the Rastas because a lot of the tenets of their religion, such as smoking marijuana, committing petty crime to fund their lifestyle, things like that, are quite simply illegal and are in most countries across the world. So they didn't get along with the police. This was not a welcome movement among Jamaicans, but they began to really grow in influence and impacted the people there with their anti-colonial type message, a message that Rastafari was basically Jesus Christ come back to earth to set them free from all of their troubles. In 1966, Emperor Selassie came to visit Jamaica, and he realized that he had a lot of people there who thought very highly of him, and he wanted to sort of make contact with them, give them the opportunity to see him in person and things like that. When he arrived at the airport, the wife of the British governor at the time met him, and as the British do when they meet royalty, she bowed down to him. Well, when all these Jamaicans saw a white woman bowing down to a black king, it was a sign to them that, wow, this guy is really powerful. This was something that they had never seen. The British government, who was ruling Jamaica at the time, had a lot of racist policies and things like that. So there was a lot of resentment there. And when they saw this, they ascribed to him even more powers of divinity and realized that this must be a great guy. And his movement continued to grow. And then in 1969, sort of taking advantage of this, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church established a chapter in Jamaica. They were trying to bring some of these Rastas into their fold to become members of their denomination. It's always been a very loose movement. They really have no texts that they refer to. You can't go look at a book and say, okay, this is what a Rasta believes, A, B, and C. Whenever you talk to them, it's very circular logic. Whenever you talk to one, you might find a way to communicate with them, but then you go talk to another Rasta, and they believe something entirely different. Really, the only common bond there is the ascription of divinity to Haile Selassie and a very anti-white, anti-colonial, anti-European, or anti-American type sentiment. So it's really more defined by almost what they're against than what they're for. So it can be very difficult to talk to them. Luckily, their influence hasn't been as broad in Jamaica as they would like, but by this time they were growing in influence, and their movement expanded far beyond what it had originally been. So it continued to grow, and they started to get more middle class membership at this time, which meant more money for propagating their message and things like that. But they were about to hit on a trouble spot, and we'll see what that was. In 1974, the emperor was overthrown by a popular uprising in his own country and placed under house arrest. And this guy, who they basically thought was God in the flesh, for him to be overthrown was very difficult for them, and they had to deal with this. It was even more difficult in 1975 when he passed away. He died. And so they said quite simply that, well, just like Jesus, he died and is coming back. They basically worshiped this man as if he were the Son of God, and sort of depend on him for their movement. And the movement has become much more diverse. Since they don't have a central text that they're referring to, it's become much more diverse, and what one believes may not be what the other believes. And it's really hard to tell exactly what they believe, but overall, whenever you talk to one, if you're from America or from a Western developed country, there's going to be a lot of resentment there, and it can be very hard to reach out to them. So it's important to try to understand what these people believe if you're trying to reach out to them, to try to realize where they're coming from, and to try to overcome some of those boundaries. They might try to get you to answer a question like, was Jesus black or white? We had one approach us just while we were walking to dinner one night and start off with that question. And our first, you know, we answered him with a question, well, how important is it really? He wasn't black or white, he was from the Middle East, he was Middle Eastern. He doesn't, you know, he didn't look like the guy who was asking us the question. He didn't look like any of us. But so many superficial arguments that really don't matter. It doesn't matter what form of government you have. It doesn't matter what color your skin is. The message of Jesus is for everyone. So this very peculiar message that they have of an ideal society to be created in Africa and all that. It's so foreign to what the gospel is. But it grew out of this almost faux Christianity. They use a lot of Christian language and stuff in their ideas. So it's difficult to communicate with them. But the important thing is to try to understand where people are coming from before you try to study with them. But what really caught my interest was why this movement that grew out of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church had such traction in Jamaica, of all places. And the more I studied, I realized that the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Seventh-day Adventist Church are both strong there. And the thing that they have in common with the Ethiopian Orthodox Church is worship on Saturdays. That's the big thing that they have in common. And it seemed like that was sort of a touching point where they would start and sort of expound on that. So I went back and studied the Ethiopian church a little bit to see where some of those beliefs came from. And it's very similar to Judaism in their style of worship. They worship on Saturdays. They keep a lot of the same feasts that Jews do and things like that. But you can see how from very small errors, you can get very far from the truth. And what I want to do with the rest of our time is to go back to the beginning of the Ethiopian church. The beginning of the Ethiopian church was not with Solomon and Sheba or anything like that. It certainly wasn't with Rastafari. But looking back at how the Ethiopian church started can show us how the church grows in every place. It's a very common message. You probably already know the story of how the Ethiopian church started. But do you realize it? It's in Acts chapter 8. It started very simply. An angel of the Lord said to Philip, who was in Samaria, having very profitable studies there, preaching, getting a good response in Samaria. The angel of the Lord said to Philip, "Rise and go toward the south, to the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. This is a desert place." It says, "Philip, your message is being heard here. You're getting lots of people to listen to you. But I'm going to take you somewhere else. I'm going to take you to a desert place. I'm going to take you to a middle of the nowhere place to do something for me." So, first question I want you to ask yourself tonight is, what is your desert place? It seems insignificant. It's not a center of culture. It's not a place that many people respect. It may be Savannah Lamar. A quiet little out-of-the-way place, rural, south side of a small island in the Caribbean. Not a place that most people have ever heard of. It may be a road from Jerusalem to Gaza. It may be your own neighborhood. Wherever it is, realize that the Lord doesn't care about the place. Because wherever He has put you is wherever He can use you. And He can use you wherever you are. So sent Philip down to this desert place, and who does he encounter but an Ethiopian, a eunuch, a court official of Candace, queen of the Ethiopians. And he was reading the prophet Isaiah. Do you know where Philip came from? He came from Galilee, like most of the other apostles. He came from this northern region of Palestine, far from Jerusalem, far from the centers of culture. He came from a place where they could be recognized by their accent. Because what did they say about Peter on the night that Jesus was crucified? "I can tell by this man's voice that he is a Galilean." They spoke with a little bit of a country accent. Those Galileans were from the middle of nowhere. They weren't that important. Philip was not a nobleman. He may have been a fisherman. He may have been a carpenter. But it's unlikely that he had ever before had a one-on-one conversation with a nobleman, someone in a position of earthly power. But did he let that stop them? Him? Did he say, no, this guy's a royal, he works in the queen's court, I can't talk to him, you need somebody more important to go talk to him? No. He saw that the Ethiopian was reading from the prophet Isaiah, and he said, "I see what I have in common with this man. I see a common point of reference that I can begin to talk to this man. I can share with this man what I know. We can have a two-way conversation, not worrying about any of the things of this world, not worrying about how important this guy's job is, or the fact that my sandals are almost worn out and I'm dusty and I've been walking on this road for several days while he's riding in a chariot." He didn't worry about any of those worldly things. He didn't let that be an obstacle to sharing the gospel. He looked for a common point of reference. And beginning with this scripture, beginning with the first thing that he saw about this man that enabled him to communicate the truth about who Jesus was, he told him the good news about Jesus. Beginning with the first opportunity he saw, he told this man the good news about Jesus. And as they were going along the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch said, "See, here is water. What prevents me from being baptized?" So we know from this that him telling him the good news about Jesus provoked a response from the Ethiopian. He realized that there was something that he needed to do. He needed to be baptized for the remission of his sins. And with that, the Ethiopian eunuch became the first convert to Christianity from Ethiopia. And he took this message back with him. When they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord carried Philip away, and the eunuch saw him no more. Can you imagine if as soon as you came out of the water, the person who taught you the truth about Christianity disappeared? What would you know? The Ethiopian was from a Jewish background. I think maybe that's where it came from. When he went back to Ethiopia, he maintained a lot of these same Jewish practices because it's what he knew. We don't have any epistles written to the Ethiopians. Most of the epistles were written to Greek-speaking churches. So for a long time, they went without a lot of the message that people like the Corinthians and the Galatians had. But eventually, the scriptures did come to Ethiopia, and there's no excuse today for them maintaining a lot of those Jewish practices to realize that we have been set free from the law and things are different now. But he went on his way rejoicing. He was so glad about this message that he had heard that he took it back to Ethiopia with him. And what did he do? If I'm joyful about something, do I just keep that to myself? Do I just keep it inside all bundled up? Or do I tell somebody about it and say, "This, listen to what happened to me. I was just going down the road, and this guy started talking to me about Jesus. And here's what Jesus has done for us." And with that, the eunuch began to tell someone the good news about Jesus. And they told someone else. And they told someone else. And that's how the church started. That's how the church grows. One person tells another person, and they tell somebody, and they tell somebody. That's how the church grows. By us talking to other people. By us being joyful and having that joy and wanting to share it with others. Wanting to tell them the good news about Jesus Christ. Many times in the New Testament, the analogies of seeds and plants are used to talk about how the kingdom grows. And Jesus used that in Matthew chapter 13. He was talking to them in parables, and he wants to tell them how the kingdom of heaven can grow from very small beginnings. From small conversations in desert places, the kingdom of heaven can grow into great things. He put another parable before them saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed that a man took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all seeds, but when it is grown, it is larger than all the garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches." So from this one of the smallest seeds known to man, you plant it, and it grows and becomes a tree so big that even eagles can come and make their nests in its branches. It becomes enormous. From small beginnings, the kingdom of heaven grows. From conversations in chariots on desert roads, from middle school classes under trees across the street from the Caribbean Sea, from conversations at the grocery store and in your classes and at your job, from people that you meet on the street, people that you work with, family members, from these small beginnings, the kingdom of heaven grows. From conversations, one person to another, sharing the joy that you have as a Christian, telling people the good news of Jesus Christ. In another passage, Jesus is talking to his disciples. He says, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." The laborers are few. And you may say, "Well, we have many workers here. We have a full-time preacher. We have elders who teach. We have Bible class teachers. We have many people who go to Jamaica year after year. We have plenty of laborers here." He's not just speaking in strict numbers here, but with relation to the size of the harvest, the laborers are few. God's never going to turn anyone away from his vineyard and say, "I've got enough workers, I don't need any more." He's always welcoming more, because the harvest can always be bigger. We can always do more. There's always some way that you can find to be involved. says, pray earnestly. At the very least, you can pray for the work of God around the world. In places like Jamaica, places like Ethiopia, South America, around the world, wherever you know that people are working to bring the truth to others, pray for them. Pray for their strength. Pray for their encouragement. Pray that they'll know the joy that comes from sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. Pray that you'll have that joy in your own heart and be able to communicate that with others. That you won't be hesitant about sharing it because you don't know how they're going to respond. But that you'll be so overjoyed about the message of what Jesus has done for you that you'll want to go out and tell everyone you know. Whether it's a desert place or the middle of a city or wherever it might be, go out and tell somebody. So I have two questions that I want to leave you with tonight. Are you praying? Are you praying for the work of God in various places? Are you praying for our brothers and sisters in Jamaica? Are you praying for our brothers and sisters around the world who go through struggles every day that we know nothing about? Are you praying that they'll remain strong? Are you praying for the work here that it will grow? Jesus said, pray earnestly. You need to pray that the harvest will be great, that there will be more laborers who will be willing to go out into the fields and labor for Him. And are you planting? What kind of seed are you planting? Whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. What kind of seed are you sowing in your life? Are you sowing seeds of joy in your heart that are going to grow up and encourage you to share the good news of Jesus with others? I hope that I've shared with you tonight some good news of what God is doing in Jamaica. I hope that you can think in your own mind about good news about what God is doing here. I hope that you want to go out to tell somebody about the good news of what Jesus has done for you in your life. If you want to be a part of that good news, if you want to receive that message, won't you come right now as we stand and sing?
Come to Jesus.